Welcome to the Planning and Community Development Committee meeting for the City of Tukwila on Monday, May 1st, 2023. And I'm going to start by introductions around the room since we have a mixed bag here. And we'll start with Councilmember Thomas.
Yeah, I'm Cloud, City Council.
Katie Wilson with the Transit Riders Union and the Stay House, Stay Healthy Coalition.
Welcome, Katie.
Artie Nazarati with the Transit Riders Union.
Is it Artie?
Artie, yeah, A-R-T-I-E.
That's what I thought. Thanks.
Nora Gerloff, Community Development Department.
Laurel Humphrey, City Council staff.
Rick Sherlock, third generation Tukwila resident.
Sean Quinn, City Council.
And I'm Kathy Polgardy. I am the council member and the chair of this committee. So welcome, everyone. Good to see you all. We have one item on our agenda today, and that is the renter protection policy proposal, which is nice because it gives us a little time to discuss it. Fortunate. So we will start with a brief introduction by Laurel, and then a presentation from Katie, I think, and Artie, yeah, and then questions, and then we'll wrap up. So that'll be the agenda process. So go ahead.
Sure. I just have a few introductory remarks to make. And the memo in your packet is an opportunity where I summarize some existing ways the city, existing programs the city has for its renters. And this is based on information that was presented at committee a couple of years ago. And then we attached the proposal as submitted by the Transit Riders Union to the City Council on April 3rd. That's the attachment on page 3. And today's meeting, from my perspective, is really an opportunity to hear from the committee questions and information you might need and next steps, direction on next steps. Page 2 of the memo, I just included a bulleted list of things you may consider as you review this proposal, including any conflicts or overlaps with state regulations, possibly a need to review recent case law, any staffing and budgetary impact of new regulations with regard to both education and enforcement, and the potential for a public outreach plan to gather feedback on the proposals. Many of the cities that have implemented a suite of rental housing protection proposals did pretty significant public outreach. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so go ahead and start. I take it we're going to use this as our reference.
Yeah, and I'm going to start with saying just maybe a little bit more like bigger picture context, and then Artie can talk a little bit more about some of the outreach work we've been doing in Tukwila and a little bit about the protections. I mean, we probably won't walk through like every single one in detail, but are happy to do that in questions.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, first of all, thank you so much for like kind of expediting this issue, and it seems like organizing a whole meeting just for this discussion. So definitely appreciate that. I guess a little bit of the wider context. So this work for us is coming out of the pandemic, and so when the COVID-19 pandemic started, that created this kind of unprecedented emergency situation where suddenly on a really wide scale, many, many people were out of work, unable to pay rent. And the policy response to that at all levels of government, from federal to state to local, was really quite remarkable. And a number of kind of emergency policies were put in place to try to prevent like widespread displacement and evictions, everything from eviction moratoriums at different levels of government. There was, a freeze on rent increases statewide. There was, late fees were prohibited. And then, of course, rental assistance. So like a really kind of huge amount of money was handed down from the federal government, from state governments to kind of fill that gap for people who are unable to pay rent for a period of time due to the pandemic. And that amounted to like a really huge transfer of resources basically to landlords to make up for tenants unable to pay rent for a time. The sum of those policies like during the pandemic was actually, I think, like remarkably successful overall, especially in Washington state, in preventing widespread evictions. So what we've seen then in the last couple of years, starting in 2021, is, you know, as we've been coming out of the pandemic, those protections are being kind of lifted. And, you know, eviction moratoriums were generally lifted in 2021. You know, rent freeze was lifted around the same time. And then slowly now, the rental assistance is kind of ending. Hopefully there will be a little bit of a continuation of that with state funds in Washington. And so that's created, over the last couple of years, an increasingly challenging rental market for renters around the state and in King County and in Tukwila. And so in early 2021, when it was becoming clear that these protections were going to start being peeled away, TRU was involved in bringing together a coalition called Stay House, Stay Healthy, which is now a King County-wide coalition of over 50 organizations, really focused on, like, how can we improve housing stability, make sure that, you know, evictions are ticking up again, but making sure that we're trying to keep that as low as possible, and really try to kind of correct some of what's a longer term, like, power imbalance between renters and landlords that is, you know, predates the pandemic, right? And so I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is in some ways a continuation and acceleration of trends that were happening before the pandemic, including large rent increases. And so, you know, around the county and in, I mean, we saw this last year when we were door knocking for the minimum wage campaign, just talking to lots of people who were talking about, like, oh, my rent is going up by $300 a month. I can't afford it. I have to move. I don't know where I'm going to go. And so the Stay House, Stay Healthy Coalition has been supporting the passage of stronger renter protections in a number of jurisdictions around the county. So far over the last couple of years, I think it's like 8 jurisdictions around the county have taken some actions to strengthen renter protections. That includes unincorporated King County, Seattle, Kenmore, Redmond, Kirkland, Issaquah, Burien, and then most recently SeaTac, which just passed some protections last month. So that's kind of the background. And, you know, we obviously have been doing a lot of organizing and outreach, community outreach in Tukwila over the last couple of years in the context of the minimum wage campaign that we were involved in last year. And just hearing so many stories from people, we're really, really eager to work with you all on trying to implement some policies that will address some of the situations that Tukwila renters have been facing. And with that, Artie.
Hi. So you have a long list of policy proposals, many of which have been passed in the city. So what I want to do is highlight some of the conversations that we've had with renters. These are people who are experiencing a lot of the issues in a way that I think, like, I'd like to present it as a reason why they're all listed together, right? It's all one big package, because many of these renters are experiencing a whole wide range of issues at the same time, right? So I want to highlight just a few. Obviously, we talked to hundreds of people here in Tukwila, and I know we've given some petitions and interest, but I wanted to give a little bit of a fleshing out of what their actual situations look like when we're talking to folks. So one person is Janet, who I hope you get to meet soon. She has, her and her mother lived in a home, and when they moved in 10 years ago, they told the landlord the roof needed to be repaired, but it was leaky, it was moisture coming in, and it was moldy. It actually was inspected twice and passed both times, and in her mind, it wasn't very satisfactory. So she took the opportunity to call Joseph at the city. By the way, shout out to Joseph P. And getting ringing endorsements from folks, the people we have talked to who have bad inspections. He came in and did an inspection and actually found that, no, the roof was completely rotten and had been for probably the entire time they were living there. And the inspection that he did made her realize that, wait, maybe the inspectors are supposed to go to all of the rooms of the house and not just be in and out in 5 minutes. He went in, he checked, he took photos, and then issued the need to repair. It was a $30,000 repair because it had been wood rotting for a decade, probably. After that, the landlord, who had refused to sign a lease because he wanted the ability to kick him out whenever, had refused to repair anything because he's not a handyman, had then threatened them and then raised the rent $800 because, you know, that was all his money that he had to repair, right? And these are all kind of things that covered in part in our policy proposal here, right? We see the strengthening the inspection program, banning the deceptive practices that this guy was saying that he's not responsible for doing, the right to not be retaliated against for like exercising your rights to an inspection. These are all things, all of which this one person has to deal with, right? This one person needed a whole like list of the things that we have in our policy proposal, right? That's why it doesn't really make sense to chop it up, because each person is largely experiencing many. Wanted to highlight Latoya. She's a mom of a small child. So for her, she didn't get much notice of a $200 rent increase, which is a lot of money for someone, a single parent trying to support her kid. And on top of that, there are also pests and roaches, a ceiling that was moldy and rotten. And so we're seeing an example of someone who was, the landlord had plenty of ability to raise the rent and ask more of her, but not give her the notice that she would need to find a place in time and make adjustments. She got, I think it was 30 to 60 days or something notice, but she has a kid and goes to school. School was starting. It takes time. It takes money to relocate, to move. And she wasn't able to do it. She was only able to do it by cutting back on groceries and, like, luckily was able to work from home and save on gas, right? Like, who knows what would have been cut next, right? But there wasn't the ability to move. And so you just kind of, like, held hostage in your own apartment, right, to make that work. So with the relocation assistance, that, right, that chunk of money may have been helpful for her to, you know, take the time, take the energy that it would take to find a place that would hopefully not move the kid out of the school that they were already in on such short notice, right? There's Stanford, who has parking fees added that weren't in his lease agreement. Meanwhile, the landlord raised rent without completing the work after sewage spilled in his apartment. So we're seeing again, there's plenty of ease of getting the rent increases out, but getting the actual work done, adding all these other fees, all that stuff is happening at the same time. There's Marjorie, who worked for 33 years. And became disabled pretty like unexpectedly with spinal issues. And for her, just getting the ability, just the basic ability to just change when her rent due date would be helpful, right? And we're seeing that this, as Katie actually already mentioned, that this crisis is going to grow because these things are happening now. Like the first kind of wave of people we were seeing, someone by the name of William saw his first rent increase last year. He was there for 2 years. It was during the COVID rent freezes. His first rent increase came in. It was $330. And it would have been even more if it was month to month, right? And so, again, we see the situation where you have a few hundred dollars of rent increases on a one-bedroom apartment. And if you think you're going to need another 1 or 2 months to find a new place, right, because how do you afford another $330? Well, then you're either stuck signing another lease or it's going to go up $500, $600 if you need another month. And then you now have to afford the cost of the moving and the time off of work to go find an apartment, all the searching, the application fees and everything, on top of now paying an extra like $500 a month to get that extra month of rent, right? Because the landlord gave him 30 days notice of this rent increase after having that 2 year freeze. So we're seeing that, again, not only are these issues really common, that each one of these things is happening a lot, it's that it's really common for each person who's experiencing these to experience a whole wide range of these issues. And so that's why we wanted to pass a comprehensive policy proposal here that actually can solve some of these problems, right? Fixing one of the things won't solve it because they'll, you know, find another place to nickel and dime you or something like that, right? And so that we need to help this wide range of issues. And again, these issues are getting worse really quickly, right? With all these rent increases happening now, the first year probably ate a lot of savings for people. They just got those rent increases. They've been paying for months for this higher rent. It's only going to get worse this next year when they get their rent increases again, right? So we want to solve this problem and get ahead of that. A majority of what we're asking for here is something that other cities, other jurisdictions have already passed. We're seeing that it's helpful in all these other places. And so now the people that we're talking to, the city of Sequoia, are looking to you to take action on that and take action on it quickly before their next rent increase comes in, that they actually get the notice that they are owed, that they can actually plan for and make adjustments to their life if they need to, that they can actually live in a safe and healthy environment, and that they actually can feel like they can call and get an inspection and get their apartment cleaned up, which isn't usually something that people feel comfortable or confident doing when they're back on their rent or whatever, right? which is, by the way, as an aside, not to go off the train, but like even when we talked to Joseph, he mentioned to us that there wasn't any protection for people on retaliation, right? That people were scared to call him, and he said they're right to be scared because it's a landlord-reported eviction. There's nothing he can do, and so there's a lot of power there that the landlord has, and so we just want to bring a little bit of that stability and that power to the renters so that they can actually exercise some of the things that they need to do to make sure they have a safe, healthy, and affordable living situation. Many of our allies who have members, labor groups, community groups, faith groups, have signed on in support of this. Their members are impacted by it. I do have a letter that I would love to share with you. I think there's three here. There's one. I just wanted to hand this letter to you. I think there's also a copy of the policy. Is that right?
We might be emailing it to us too, so we can talk about this.
Sure. And this is it's kind of a draft in the sense that more organizations are going to be signing on.
I do appreciate the hard copies. I'm always talking to our legislative but also send us this on email.
Those are the collector's edition letters. We just wanted to get you that in person. And make that handoff. But yeah, again, just wanted to highlight some of those voices because I think it's easy to look at a bunch of legalese, look at I know that there might be, you're going to mention this, Katie, that we might have a draft of legislation at some point in the future soon. It'll be easy to like lose the humanity in some of the legalese and stuff. We did try to capture a lot of the issues that people were actually telling us. And that's why, for example, we wanted to strengthen the inspection program because we saw what Tupelo was doing. It's great that there is an inspection program here. It sounds like when there's inspection done by Joseph, that inspection has been really good and helpful. And we want to, again, just mimic and build off of that for everybody else and make that something that people actually can exercise, right? So thank you for hearing me and relaying some of those stories to you.
Great. So I have a proposed way of us doing this. And the first so we'll do two rounds, unless you guys don't want to do this, but this is my suggestion. The first time around, let's ask questions, clarifying questions. And then the second, then we'll go around again and then just talk about like what we are, our thoughts on it. That way, because there's a lot of information here and that might be one way to separate it out. So, do I have agreement with you guys? Is that one for you?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'll start with you, Councilman Quinn.
Yeah. So I have a couple questions. And so I know this is kind of the initial conversation, so I want to understand some issues more and, you know, in our role, balancing considerations as we think about policy proposals. So maybe I'll reference this. sorry. The question I have, because some of these things are actually codified in state law, So banning evictions in the winter. And what's the other one that came to mind? And then just kind of watching how some of the proposals have unfolded in Berrien and CTEC. So just from your perspective, just in this space where you've done real work, but also got a chance to do the legislative process.
Yep.
I guess, is there anything new that you would add to what's here, learnings that you've had in engaging? And I would just say I appreciate the bringing up the human side. That's always the way that I think about it. And I think if we talked about it more, then we would kind of continue to humanize the situation and also the consideration that is before us, right? Because then you have also the business side that we have to balance in our work. So I'm just wondering if there's new kind of
new information,
new learnings from some of the things that you've read.
Sure. I mean, I would say, so there were a couple of, there were a few bills in the state legislature that would have implemented, you know, some stronger statewide protections. So there were two rent stabilization bills that would have actually, like, limited the degree to which landlords can raise the rent to, like, I think it was like between 3% and 7%, depending on the rate of inflation. Those proposals did not pass. So they didn't make it out of their house of origin. And we, you know, as you probably know, you know, we have a state ban on localities doing rent stabilization policies. So that's, we could not do like a exact version of that kind of policy in Tukwila. Mm-hmm. The other significant renter protections bill that was considered in the state legislature was, I think it's this one, HB 1124, which would have, required 180 days notice for rent increases greater than 5%. It would have given the tenant the right, faced with such a rent increase, to leave their lease early, like to find a new place. And I think there was, it would have banned month-to-month fees as well. So basically saying that a landlord can't charge more for a month-to-month lease than for, you know, a normal year-long or whatever lease. That bill also did not make it out of South of Origin. So basically, we're left with a situation where the state legislature this year did not end up passing any significant renter protection bills. And so we believe that all of these things are things that Tukwila and other cities are able to do on top of the renter protections that have been established in state law. I mean, there are, like, in some of these areas, there are, so for example, Washington State does require 60 days notice of any rent increase, right? But there's no prohibition on localities going above and beyond that and requiring longer notice. And in fact, many localities have. So in Seattle, there's 180 days notice required of any rent increase at all. And then many other cities around the county have now done something kind of similar to this, 120 days for greater than 3%, 180 days for greater than 5% or 10% is what a number of cities have done. So the only piece of this where I think you're going to find some really significant legal differences of opinion about what cities can do is in the just cause protections part. And that's where there are now a number of jurisdictions that have local just cause laws that strengthen the state just cause law. And one of the ways that some of them strengthen the state just cause law is by explicitly extending it to cover fixed term leases, so that you basically are saying, if you're on, for example, a year lease, the landlord needs to have a good reason not to offer you a new lease at the end of that, basically. And so Seattle has a version of this called the right of first refusal law, and then Kenmore, unincorporated King County, both also have, in Federal Way and Auburn, all have local just cause laws that cover fixed term leases. Now, there's, don't want to get necessarily too in the weeds here, but Burien did a similar thing. And then there was a weird court decision, which was like an unpublished opinion that's like not actually legally binding, but then their city attorney told them, like, well, you have to strike this language because we think this conflicts with state law. And so they ended up striking the language that explicitly extended Burien state cause or just cause law to fixed term leases. I think it's kind of an open question whether that binds any, even Burien, let alone other jurisdictions, because again, these other jurisdictions still have these laws on the books and they're being used in housing court to defend people from lease termination. So anyway, that is kind of like a big legal muddle, but CTAC followed Burien and not including that bit because they were worried about the legality of it. So I think you might get different opinions depending on who you ask. We think it's fine to go ahead and copy Auburn or Federal Way or Seattle or any of the cities that have done this. I don't know what you as a city attorney would advise you to do.
So just a quick follow-up on the there's so many questions come up there, but the fact that those bills died in the legislature, I mean, you always hear why, or so I'm just curious if you've heard why they died.
I mean, They actually did remarkably well, I would say, for being like the first time that they were proposed. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with them next year, I think. Yeah. I mean, as you probably know from watching the state legislature, it takes bills, you know, sometimes many years. I mean, how long was it before we hit the capital gains tax was considered, right? So, yeah, I mean, I think probably it would be interesting to talk with a couple of the legislators who maybe worked on those bills and get their perspective. I was not, like, in those rooms, so I don't want to speak on behalf of the legislature, but they had a lot of support, and I don't think they were ever, they weren't like voted down, they just didn't make it to a floor vote, basically.
Okay, so
they didn't, it's not that they didn't pass, they didn't make it onto the floor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they, yeah, it wasn't the people voted against
them. Right.
And I can, I'll see if I can get some perspective from legislators about kind of like what happened to share.
That's great.
So I'll turn this off. I have some questions, just pondering questions that maybe we can.
I want to talk about big picture when we start.
Yeah, it's more big picture, but it's also involved, you know, city staff. And,
yeah. And, you know, so yeah, this is sort of like our clarifying, you know, more details.
Yeah. Well, okay. Maybe I will, now that I think about it. So, Nora, I'm just wondering if we have a rental inspection, I mean, what's the greatest sense we would know whether or not there are catching the things that need to be caught? I mean, it's a real question because we've gone back and forth with heavy city staff versus contract and then more city, you know, more city code enforcement. So I'm just high level though. I mean, I'm thinking that like this is a conversation about how we build a framework. And so the hope is that it'll be informed also internally on our practices because you can have a perception, but then there's the reality of implementation and things that are being seen. So,
when we were setting up the program, we were told that legally we needed to offer a private inspection option because we couldn't require that the city had access to the property. So we needed to have dual systems. When we have found that we've gotten a complaint about a rental unit that had been previously inspected by a private inspector, if it's been egregious enough, we've contacted all of the tenants that have used that same private inspector and said, hey, want a courtesy inspection? Maybe we heard that this guy was missing some stuff. And so we've had to try and follow up and weed out inspectors that we feel like we're not doing a thorough job. So I was just emailing my Joseph to see whether the previous case had been a private inspector or not, and I did to follow up. Properties
you can look at. Okay. I guess that's but I want to make sure we go do around. I have another question.
Sure, we can go around. There's a lot of information here, so we'll probably have to go around several times.
And I'll just do a previous question. Like you asked like if there was anything else that we had identified that wasn't on the paper. We did try to, we heard a lot of stuff actually. People had a lot of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
We did try to take those ideas and as much as possible mm-hmm. include them, but we also did like try to screen as much as possible so that this was an actual like realistic document.
Mm-hmm.
One of the proposals that we did here is that we had a few people who say like there shouldn't be private inspections because they don't do a good job, and we heard from our attorney the same thing that you weren't able to do it right. So that's why like there's a little bit of an opening here about how do you make it better. You know, there's a few other things that we also talked to folks about that we tried to again just like include mm-hmm. what we could, but we wanted to make sure we weren't giving you like unrealistic pie in the sky, like let's make housing perfect. We try to give you like realistic concrete things, but we did try to do our due diligence there and taking as much from a fit from folks, but then also again like putting it through a little bit of a filter for what would be reasonable for you.
No, I mean thank you for saying it, and I think just in our process is just uncovering
mm-hmm.
what is, you know, in the realm of possibility, but also, you know, making sure we hear from the folks that are implementing it, and for whatever mechanism, as we think about a framework to build around it. So that's You know, there'll probably be more institutional questions that I'll be asking as well.
Mm-hmm. We'll go ahead.
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah.
Nora, do you know about how many rental units are in Tekoa? I guess it's okay.
I think we've got 8,000 some total housing units, and 60% of those, I think, are rental. So, you're the accountant.
If it's 60%, it won't be. Have you heard or has it been in discussion, something I didn't see in here, but I've heard people speak to this, that a person can leave a unit, leave it clean, but the landlords keep their security deposit and cleaning deposit. Have you heard that a lot?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know if I have heard that specifically from Tekoa people, but just being around the, like, in the Stay House, Stay Healthy Coalition, and especially the folks who do tenant legal counseling and everything, deposits not being returned happens all the time. Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't include the full story, but even this one person is such a good example, but
Janet,
yeah, thank you. She had been doing a lot of kind of self-lawyering on this, and I think that there's even something I wasn't aware of, but like apparently a right to get the status of your deposit, security deposit.
Yeah,
and she asked in December and has yet been unable to get the status of it as she's moving out. So she's just assuming that the landlord who has failed at every turn will just keep the entirety of the deposit. She has no expectations of it coming through, despite the fact that she has been screwed over in every turn from this one person. So yeah, it's pretty common that there's no the security deposit evaporated money for most people.
But that's a significant amount.
It is, of course.
Yeah.
Especially because you need it when you have to move because your rent is going to either go up $400, you have to find a new place, and the next place is asking for first month, last month, and deposit, which is also why we wanted to remove that hurdle from folks too, a little bit there.
Yeah, that's a good question. We can ask folks at the Housing Justice Project if there are any policy ideas on that. I know one state-level idea that just made me think of that also hasn't passed but's been proposed a couple of times is creating, and it kind of applies more broadly to kind of enforcement of tenant protection laws, is creating, I think it's called like the lawyers probably know this like a summary proceedings process or something like that, so that like as a tenant, if something happens, like your deposit's not returned unfairly, instead of having to like lawyer up and sue, which like no one has the means to do, there's a kind of a streamlined court process where that's handled at superior court, where you basically just go in, fill something out, and then like a decision can be made fairly quickly on an issue like that. And I think that would require a state level law to make that happen. But anyway, that's like relevant, but there might be other policy things as well.
Have you, in putting some of this together, had any input from landlords or some sort of landlord association, or is this just purely from the renter's side?
I mean, I guess to the extent that a lot of these policies have been passed in other cities where there was this back and forth and where elected officials were kind of like hearing from both sides, you could say that that's input. I mean, we haven't sat down with the landlord groups. To be very honest, like the RHA, especially in the Multifamily Housing Association, I mean, they tend to be very oppositional on this stuff. And we haven't really, we don't really have like a working relationship where we sit down and negotiate.
That's my question.
We've talked this before, and now I still have lots of questions, and I lost my first sheet of paper with all my notes. So, but I'm just going to start. Okay. The relocation assistance. Let's just talk about that. My question would be, tell me again, you've told me before, but tell me again what your ideas are. You've got some stuff written down, but would you just talk me through that?
Yeah, so the idea here and the two precedents that exist are Portland, Oregon, which passed a policy like this several years ago, and then Seattle, which passed this policy 2 years ago. And basically the idea is that if a landlord raises the rent by an exorbitant amount, you can decide what that is. In Portland and Seattle's case, it's over 10%. Then and the tenant moves out because they can't afford it. Then a landlord, the landlord has to pay relocation assistance of some amount to the tenant. And you could look at this as kind of a way. So like if you think of the rent stabilization laws that were proposed at the state level this year, that would have limited rent increases to between 3% and 7%. I mean, that's lower than 10%, right? So it's like, well, we can't actually limit rent increases, but what we can do is say that if the landlord really wants to raise the rent that exorbitant amount, there's going to be some consequences. And, you know, I think that the way that this law has worked in Seattle so far, some data that I got from SDCI does suggest that the law is actually causing landlords to, not universally, but some landlords to keep the rent increases just under 10%. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else to say about this.
Okay, so probably that would be what any landlord would do unless they were, like, really cash-strapped, right? They would just be like, I'm going to go to 9.9% or something, but it would keep it from going to 12 or
15. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, there are still, I mean, people in Seattle are still getting, you know, 20, 30% rent increases, even with the law. So it's like if a corporate landlord might just decide that they have a new policy where they're raising all the rents by 30% and fine, mm-hmm. we'll eat the relocation assistance, you know, costs.
They kind of hold it out.
Yeah,
that'll work.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's the idea. I shared an article with you that I'd written kind of about how Seattle's program's working, which is like there are definitely some challenges. And I think it would be possible to do a very streamlined version that wouldn't require like city staff, which is kind of Seattle's program is like the tenant applies to the city for relocation assistance. And then the city has to recover the funds from the landlord, which is proving very challenging. But the way that Portland does it is a lot simpler. And there's a proposal in Tacoma to do it this way, too, where it's just basically saying the landlord is supposed to pay tenant. And then, you know, it's up to the tenant, I guess, to sue the landlord if that doesn't happen. So the enforcement's a little tricky. But at least the city is not on the hook for, like, mediating that transaction, basically. But it's just establishing this right to this relocation assistance.
So we talked about how most or a lot of these have been passed in other cities.
Yeah.
I would like to know, and you can email this to the committee, like which ones of these are in which cities?
We have a great chart that I will email to all of you.
Yes.
Yes.
That's what I want.
Okay. Yes.
That would be great. Because that way we know specifically.
Yep.
You know, that's, otherwise that's kind of a really broad statement.
Yeah.
Like what ones does Seattle have? What does Erie have? That would be really helpful.
Yep.
So that would be one question that I would have. I will save my opinions for the next round. Relocation assistance. I see if I have any other questions that haven't been answered yet. There's a lot in here. Regulation of, we could talk about all of these, but we are going to be having further conversations. Fixed income to change rent due date. I have opinions about that. Additional protections. Okay. And then the additional protections worth considering. I don't have any questions, so now I just have thoughts. So let's go around again. If you have questions, go for it. But start with thoughts if you want to do that.
Yeah, I have kind of questions and thoughts. Just knowing that until we did the rental inspection permits. And so these are kind of high level past floor. I'm hoping you can kind of capture some of these thoughts as we think about impacts, right? and maybe I'll start with a question. Just your sense of the timeline it's taken to kind of do some of these. So maybe when we think about the chart, maybe the time and the process associated with that, I'd be very much interested in that. So get back to us on that, right? Because I'm just thinking about the framework. So here's kind of the opinion and the question. So what's really intriguing in a lot of these things is that they're kind of loose in it laws that require steps by the landlords and require steps by the tenants. And most of the time we see the requirements shifting heavily towards the tenants. And so I really like this concept around the if you raise it by 10%, this relocation assistance, but having it really clean, because it requires an action on both sides. And the documentation speak to it, right? And you have to kind of prove that you've actually treated someone according to the guidelines. The other question, Laurel, I have is just thinking about insurance. City insurance. And whatever the limitations associated, I would assume some of the jurisdictions have decided whether or not that this could impact their WCIA insurance. So sometimes when you think about laws, not just this law, you think about other laws, insurance companies, right? They will say, here's how we read the law. And if you do this, you're going to be in violation. So we, you know, you can decide to go in and be sued, and then that's going to affect the rates for everyone. So I'd just be curious around the kind of WCIA. And I say that because some of this is just applied in implementation, and then also sometimes actions will generate a need to make an adjustment because, let's just say on either end, but I'll just say on the landlord end, they're not following up on the commitments that they actually have a contract on, and then that disproportionately impacts the tenant. So I'd be curious about that. But the 10% piece is really intriguing. And then thinking about that, in lieu of that, like the outright ban and the limitations associated with banning a tool, in my mind, I want to tie it to an action and to, we all have contracts, so you have to go through it, you know, follow the contract. Could have started by saying, I wonder, you know, just to really kind of get the brainstorming. And then also on the deceptive and abusive practices, and I've heard about this country, and this may be a balancing financial components, but what came to mind is legal aid and the role that municipalities can play.
On that piece, my understanding is that this gives like lawyers who are assisting tenants more tools, the banning deceptive and abusive practices a bit.
Right, but still stuck at this, right? Or in the courts. Yeah, I have more questions around the leases. I would assume to have a business license, you kind of have to comply with landlord, whatever. And I also, at least I've had the experience of you get two choices. You can go month to month, and if you go month to month, there's going to be a significant increase, and there's not a real justification why. So around, if you have an action, what is the requirement for a justification that follows or documentation? So that's a question. And I would be curious to also talk to our legislative panelists on what we've heard about these previous bills. Let's see, I have a bunch of more. I took a bunch of notes.
Do you want to go around again? Or do you want to keep going? I'm thinking that this is really good because this is all, this will be it's recorded, right? And so we can refer to this as far as like getting answers and things. So it's good that we have this time and that we can tell other council members to listen to this, right? And it, of course, there will be some a lot of repeating of things, but I like the fact that we're getting these out mm-hmm. and answered, and there will be more.
This stuff really requires repetition. Like, I've been immersed in this stuff for, like, 3 years, and I still, like, forget things.
Yeah.
Like, wait, what was that again?
Exactly.
Well, and then if you pass something, things, adjustments will be made.
Yes, totally.
Somehow.
Yeah, and then the why. Also, yeah, like an old why.
So, I just had a couple more. And the one that seemed like kind of a no-brainer is on the increase of fees and penalties and the documentation. So I just wonder, I'd be curious for the city attorney around some of those processes. And then the next one is this proactive education and outreach. I know we've been doing quite a bit of it. Nora, I know there's a process where if we do have an egregious contractor who's doing the inspections, there's a process, and then they could potentially not be on the roster, right?
Yeah, we can't keep the law.
Okay. So I'd be curious to learn a little bit more on that. I really like this because it forces us to kind of really discover, you know, what's 2023 policy versus a 2018 policy, and why are folks experiencing? Of course, that's important, but also what tools do we actually have? And so I would have a lot of questions also for the city attorney. So, and I'll stop there for now, but I just think there's enough to, like, really kind of build up.
Well, we've got time, so you think it's more. We'll go around again. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a couple that kind of catch my eye. And in particular, like on the first one, the additional notice of rent increased for the state 60. Now I'm just trying to think, you know, if I was a renter and I was given 60 notice, days notice, I probably feel a little bit jammed with that.
Mm-hmm.
But probably would appreciate at least 90,
mm-hmm.
you know, give me a little bit of time to see what I could find.
Yeah.
So while the state says 60, you know, I would lean towards at least 90 in our city. The just cause protect or there's a couple of them here, like we say cap on move-in cost or relocation assistance. Maybe if people left a place like they found it and then they were assured of getting their security deposit back, it would help in those two areas. So I'd like to see something that would kind of assure people or that they have a hope of getting their security deposit back because in their mind, they're probably planning on being able to use that for the next place.
Yeah,
and you could help in those two areas for sure. I do like on the backside here. I would like to hold landlords accountable. And one of them here is no rent increases permitted for units that fail inspection.
Yeah,
no rent. Yeah, you know, and then identify landlords that are slow to fix units or you know do things that just really related directly to living conditions. But yeah, I think we'd want to lean on them quite a bit. Now, when I say that, and what I will say now may not be relevant to this conversation, but let me just put it on the table. Because I know some landlords told me, and it could be just during COVID, I'm not sure, but they had renters who didn't pay rent because they didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they later found that they used that money to buy a house later.
Mm-hmm.
So from the landlord side, they're thinking, wow, people were using the COVID rules,
mm-hmm.
you know, to kind of, but that might have been just because of COVID and the circumstances kind of allowed for that.
You can find, yeah, examples that are, I mean, you could always point to a bad actor in any mm-hmm. angle or whatever. And another example was a tenant who had the rent increase. Before COVID, it was asked of them, but they weren't given enough notice before the COVID rules went into effect. So they're paying the pre-COVID rent. But the landlord was able to, they paid that rent, but the landlord was able to recoup the increase that they wanted from one of the programs, the rent assistance.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you had this like short notice rent increase thing, but he managed to get the money for it, but the people were paying the rent and being really honest about it. So it's like, I think that I don't want to point to any one egregiously bad example in any one angle on it, but
yeah, I mean, I think that probably, I think the data show that overwhelmingly during COVID, like vast majority of renters like continue to pay rent on time. I'm sure that there are some instances of, you know, that's like, oh, well, I can't be kicked out. Like, let's see what's for a down payment. But in normal circumstances, without eviction moratoriums, you know, you're immediately at risk of getting 14-day pay or vacancy notice. So I think most renters make paying rent on time a high priority above other bills.
So let me ask about allow renters on fixed income to change rent due date. What is defining as fixed income?
I think in the other cities that have passed this, it's generally like income from a public source that comes in on a particular day of the month. So it might be like Social Security or disability or some other like monthly public income. And the idea is that, like, okay, I don't control when I get this. It comes in on the 10th of the month, right? And so what that means is that if my rent is due on the 1st, by the time I get to the 1st, like, I've been, you know, trying to pay other bills or whatever, and I don't have enough left for rent. I would, you know, rent is really important to me because I don't want to lose my housing, so I would rather have it so that I can pay rent on the 11th right after my Social Security check comes in.
I think it'll be important to maybe define and articulate what we're calling fixed income.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, with all this stuff, Artie mentioned this, but we can actually, one thing that the King County Bar Association's Housing Justice Project has been doing is for some of the other cities, like doing a first draft. And then they can, the city staff, city attorney can look at that. And then they can also look at obviously what other cities have passed. And so we will definitely have some sample language of this. And then you can also look at what other cities have done. But yeah.
And I think people then that are on either a fixed income or a set income, you know, they shouldn't be discriminated against because they have, you know, a means of income. If they can pay the rent, they can pay the rent.
Right. And I believe we do have a state law, like a source of income discrimination law.
Yeah.
So that is something that is handled at the state
level. Well, was that in here? Where did I read that? Oh, maybe I read it over here in the memo. I read something like that. Oh, yeah, source of income discrimination is here.
Yeah.
So, I think that was important as well as Mona was talking about.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe they pay on a different day of the month.
Yeah.
But are consistent with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. That's it for this week.
Okay. One other thing I'll just flag is that, because we mentioned that, like, almost all of this stuff has been passed in some other jurisdiction. The biggest exception to that is in the section called Regulate Additional Fees and Costs Added to Rent. This is kind of a newer area where it's almost an emerging problem where more and more there's like these kind of ridiculous like high fees, like, oh, here's an administration fee when you sign your new lease. It's $200.
Yeah.
What is that for? Huh, right? So this is something where the only example I'm aware of so far in King County is that Seattle recently passed legislation that, in addition to capping late fees, also prohibited notice delivery fees. So that's one of the examples in this section. So that has been done in Seattle. But these other kinds of fees, like admin fees, month-to-month for fees, lease renewal fees, service fees, billing fees, no one has tackled that. So that's just to note that there's not a precedent there, but it's definitely an increasing problem that we're seeing and are interested in figuring out if there's a way to tackle it.
If I could on that one, so when you talked about the example of whether someone asked to pay a parking fee that wasn't in that original contract, like that's what I mean on, like, you have a document that you swear by, like, in those situations when someone gets an additional fee and it's not in the lease agreement. But I don't know what arm would be the, you know, like, I know at the state level we get that consumer protection, but the fundamentals, like, that there has to be a nexus, just like there's a nexus. We have a responsibility to have a nexus as well.
I think it's worth mentioning that, like, enforcing this and anything you pass is obviously really important, and you should try to find ways to do that. It's also, I think, just worth mentioning that when we talk to attorneys and they're helping people through evictions, that it is helpful for when the renters have rights, that they're able to point to the rights and find that the landlord has failed one or two or three of these things and hasn't followed their duty up, that, you know, even if you were worried that you weren't able to fully enforce every single possible violation, giving these rights to tenants can have, like, self-enforcement, like, mechanisms when, you know, when it's triggered by the landlord, making an unjust eviction, right? They haven't been fulfilling this list of things. And of course, there will be people fall through the cracks, which is always unfortunate. But I think it's just important just to keep in mind that even if granting these rights to tenants, even if you're not able to think of the strongest possible enforcement mechanism, simply granting these rights does have a benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. And most of the cities that have done these things have not like expanded their, you know, staff devoted to these areas or something. It's really more just been like, we are passing this law.
Right.
So it hasn't, and I think the inspection program stuff is the stuff that obviously will be, raises the most questions about staff and capacity and everything. But a lot of these other things are more just like, here's a policy.
Okay. And pretend. So you're going to have to wear. If you think about kind of efficiency, but also trying to maximize the authority that you do have, when it's something that is involved with kind of an agreement or a process to conduct business, I think there's a easier nexus versus kind of not being thoughtful about how you would implement it and then the boundary that could potentially come with it. So that's why these detailed questions and to me this process is really good, because this will spark ideas around process, because policymakers, what we do is we work it and have it informed and do pros and cons and get staff, but it doesn't mean that something hasn't been identified that could be a way to achieve it. Contribution.
All right, so I have thoughts. One thing, just looking at this overall, is where do I want to start? I want to start with the fact that I said to Katie that politics is the art of compromise, and that you know realistically you're not going to get everything that's in this document, because there's just going to be stuff that, for example, we need to take a look at how the true manpower cost of implementing this. You've given us some ideas how what that might be, but we have to look at it and say, so what do we think with our reality, what the manpower cost is going to be? Because right now we are short staffed, no matter what anybody says. And we, if we have to hire people in order to, let's say, if we, here's the best example. If we went to city inspectors, we would simply have to hire. Is that correct? I don't know how you would do 5,000 inspections.
So when we first started the program, we did have all inspections done by the one inspector, and that was her full-time job. And I think we'd also need to look at some way to spread them out more evenly through the year, whereas now we say do in September, and we do a lot in September, right, which would be beyond one capacity. So, yeah, I think we'd need to think about doing things differently. And also whether right now our rental housing person also does rental housing code enforcement, not just the inspection program. So we would shift our balance of work.
Well, my math, which is probably wrong, is like 3 a day every day of the year to get through 5,000 units. I don't know. I think my math is wrong. You could do that.
I'll check you.
Good. Because what we do is we do one quadrant. We do it every 4 years, one quadrant.
Right.
And then plus you've got to do the other ones that have questions. So that this is just reality. There are some things in here that I think are really straightforward. It's like yes and amen to these ones. I have two sons. I told Katie this too, that are like moving around renting all the time, and one of them is moving from Buffalo to Texas, somewhere in some suburb, and their move-in fees are capped. Well, so $500 move-in fee plus your first step. That gives you access to housing, right?
Yeah.
And then they probably have some way to like, you know, like there might be a deposit fee or something. I don't know. But it's like totally different than here. Totally different than here. And they're making that work. So I think that that's really good. Another thing that I was thinking is that when we have, predatory landlords, I'm just going to call it that, you know, where things are really bad, we're talking about legal aid. You know, is there some sort of legal aid group that could come out and help to help renters? Because like I said, another story is that my middle son was having problems with
water coming down their unit and then not fixing it. So they just moved, right? And their landlord was saying that you had to, you're breaking your lease, so you have to pay. And, you know, his brother was a lawyer. So he lawyered up, right? My son. And then they, and boom, it was all fixed.
Yeah.
Right. So I think they just we're not messing with this.
Yeah.
So what if there was like some sort of service like that where, I see that there's legal aids.
Yeah.
Can they do that?
So that exists to a certain extent. So there's a few organizations in King County that do legal assistance for tenants. There's the Housing Justice Project, which is associated with the King County Bar Association. There's the Tenant Law Center, which is part of Catholic Community Services.
Oh, yeah.
There's the Eastside Legal Assistance Program. There might be, I think, both went. So there's a couple of those as well. I think the challenge is that they're so over strapped with and as a result they have to narrow the people that they serve.
Yeah.
So a lot of them, I mean, they'll definitely have like an income threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And then often they really specialize in eviction defense, so they'll only take a case for people who are imminently at risk of eviction.
Mm-hmm.
So just because they don't have the capacity to serve everyone, they're trying to take on like the most urgent, most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Kind of cases.
So it really doesn't exist for everybody.
Exactly.
It's basically what you're saying.
Exactly.
There's some out there, but it doesn't exist for everyone. Because I've seen, and on same son, something like that happened. A lot of times they'll just back down right away if you come at them.
Yeah.
But the thing is, first of all, how do some people know that are renting and all that kind of, there's all sorts of reasons you don't even know that that's a possibility, and you're not feeling.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, the power imbalance that you feel from that. And those things. So anyway, I thought about that. Yeah.
Question, because I'm just thinking about kind of reference to legal aid. There are kind of nonprofit, not for profit, but it doesn't mean potentially a conversation around a contract as a, you know, just as a, I mean, standalone contract with lawyers to do legal aid to a certain threshold. Because I asked the question, as we represent our residents, it's also representing those that are impacted, that work here, and that live here and have rental issues. But that's a bigger conversation and maybe a bigger threshold. But just I think assuming that we can lean on the existing nonprofits or other organizations, so I'm saying that's a creative way to maybe have kind of a clearinghouse of options for folks versus just assuming that someone we can add to their workflow versus does it make sense as a public benefit, and we would have to engage that question.
Mm-hmm.
to think about a,
mm-hmm.
You know,
there's possibly some examples you could look at if you were, I mean, I don't think we gave like a very detailed like request on like how you enforce these components, but if you were interested in like partnering, but you didn't want to hire a bunch of lawyers to try to find an office space back there for them, it probably won't be an answer to say like here's a hotline of an organization who's already booked up as a way of obviously, but there are like other like it can be cost effective probably for the city to look at enforcement mechanisms that like I think both the Port of Seattle and like the Office of Labor Standards of Seattle have engaged in community partnerships on enforcement, and they'll partner with legal clinics who are already doing some stuff to take some of the workload. So in some cases, like the Office of Labor Standards does have investigators and lawyers on staff, they'll take some cases directly. They'll also partner in doing some of the enforcement outreach work with the Fair Work Center and Casa Latina and other organizations. And that's through a grant process.
Mm-hmm.
It ends up being lower overhead on their end. There's also the organizations are already skilled, already know what they're doing, already providing the work. And so what you're really providing is essentially a grant to expand their capacity to what they're already doing. I think the Port did that also for CTEC Prop 1 enforcement. Somewhat like recently, even though like the law passed a while ago, I think they did that fairly recently. A grant to do some outreach and enforcement on worker rights stuff. And I don't know if there's any renter protections equivalents. I'm sure there's something.
It might be worth hearing from the Tenant Law Center folks about the scope of their work, because I know that Housing Justice Project is very evictions focused, but I think the Tenant Law Center is a little bit broader in the kinds of cases that they're able to take on. So there might be something there.
Yeah, I know much more about like, the labor side of stuff, like renter protection details on the back end is not my expertise, but I can point to some like several examples of like using that as, again, like trying to keep in mind like the scope of what you're trying to achieve here, like probably not setting up a new government agency.
No.
But there are ways, like if
you're trying to strike terror in the park.
No, the opposite. If you have the interest and are committed to enforcing and looking ways to do it, there are precedents of like low overhead, but still like meeting the commitment that you're seeking there. By working with oral organizations and just working with them to expand their capacity to meet the needs that you want to meet here.
So I have a couple other, well, I have more things. So this is another example of city staff time, that these things really sound good, but we got to look at our city enforcement. No rent increases permitted for units that have failed to pass inspection or have outstanding requests for repairs or have defective conditions. So that would be like, there'd have to be some mediation by the city. So we're going to have to think about, you know, we just have to throw that in the hopper. Okay. And then also increase audits and assess the efficacy of the third party inspection companies. And that we've already talked about, you know, how we're handling that now, Nora, tell me if I'm right, is that we have a list of approved inspectors that we know to be reliable. And so that is how we are addressing that right now. So, and then there's some thoughts that I have, like allow renters on fixed income to change rent due date. I think maybe it might be reasonable to modify that to say they can either choose the 1st or the 15th or maybe three times a month, and not, you know, it's going to get really complicated if it's like, do you want the 3rd or the 24th? You know, if you could do it on this or this, because the person that had their rent due on the 11th, that might, I mean, their payment on the 11th, if their rent was due on the 15th, that might be more helpful for them. So some of these types of moderations that might be more helpful to keep things standardized or not. I mean, again, these are just my thoughts, right? So things that I'm thinking of. Ban deceptive and abusive practices. Of course, we don't want any deceptive and abusive practices. It's just the how of that, right? And I think that, yeah, so that might be sort of a big issue that we got to figure out. What does that look like that's really enforceable? I do, like I said, we've got predatory landlords here, and I just love to say, but we also have mom and pop landlords, and that's something that we haven't talked about yet. And it's something that Katie and I talked about, and I said that in some cities, they are like saying, we're exempting people that own 4 units or less from maybe some or all of this, you know, not the rent increases would be, you know, you would have to, but some of the other ones they might be exempt from. And then you were talking about the LLCs, like people put each unit in LLCs. And then it was interesting because I was talking to a friend who had at one time boats, and she said we had to put each boat in an LLC to protect that particular property so that nobody like sued us on one boat and we lost all the other boats. So there's, you know, there's different ways of seeing why people are doing that.
Sure.
And then the other is like, you know, you're gonna have some people that are gonna be able to slip through the cracks on that, but then basically it's helping the majority of mom and pops that are, you know, that they gotta pay that, you know, they decided not to sell their house and they moved to another one, and so they got 2 mortgages to pay, so they got to get that rent to pay that one. And you have a rental that way. So somebody that is you have one more house that's a rental market, and we want to have houses that's rental. So I just, there's a lot of I'm curious as to what the why months to months might be more expensive for a landlord to do rather than leases. And maybe that's more of a small, you know, like you can exempt smaller ones because it costs them more for some reason. But again, there's a lot of stuff going on. That happens in Tukwila where people are really struggling because of
of rental issues that that these things can be helpful. So it's just about doing it right. And so, yeah, so I'm really talking big picture here with a few details put in. I have a suggestion to the committee. I think the first pass that this needs to go through is our legal, to see what our legal says about this. And then from there, we'll go to the next step after that. So I'm asking my fellow council members if you have a different thought of how what we might do next. But I really, if our legal says this isn't going to work for Tuckwilla, we got to address that before we address anything else. Do we think yes, no, you know, what? So the first thing that I think it needs to do is go through legal. And then instead of doing it last and like spending all this work on it and then having legal say, that didn't work for us here.
Yeah. I'm okay with that. I would like to see though, maybe you said you have a chart.
Oh yeah, we want all that.
I'd like to see that chart
at the same time.
Of what we're thinking for Tuckwilla and how that compares to the state and other cities.
We have that chart. I can send it to you tomorrow. Yeah.
Can you copy it, please?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
And then the other thing is that, like, you know, legal, that'll help with this. You're doing that at the same time, so we can do addressing that. Yes.
So I think it's fair and consistent with our process.
Mm-hmm.
We always have legal review. It doesn't mean that something's going to stop. It's just, okay, we have one more contribution. I actually appreciate that we got this on the agenda. We got to hear about it. And my assumption is we're going to work it until we can't work it anymore.
We'll send it to
the full council, but with thinking and pros and cons and ideas, because I actually have a bunch of questions that I'll send coming out of this meeting. You and then maybe we can include it in the packet. Just I have some thoughts or ideas, but having the legal review, like that's part of our job.
And that doesn't mean everything freezes while it's going through legal. I mean, you could talk to us and we can tell you what we're finding out, but that's your first process.
Okay.
It's to, you know, we don't just stop, but that's the first thing that we typically do is legal review. And then I would say probably after that is a staff review is the next thing. And then, you know, we'll just keep
bring it back here.
Yeah, let's bring it back here between with each one. So back here. We might have to do more offline. It's really unusual to this just be the only thing on the agenda. So we've had a lot of luxury to be able to talk about it. So we might have to do a little bit more offline and then just summary during the meeting. And also, like I said, I like this because all this conversation was recorded so that, you know, it's not like, well, man, what did we say on the, you know, like our conversations? What did I say? So we can just go back and listen to it. With me, that's like, listen to it while you're doing the dishes or something. You know, not too painful. Any other conversation, anything, any comments that you'd like to make in closing?
I think that this is a great initial discussion, and thank you again for, you know, for having us in here to go through all this in such detail, and happy to continue the conversation whatever way works. We'll send along that chart tomorrow morning, if not tonight, and then we'll send along just like a draft that Housing Justice Project comes up with that, you know, you guys can use, city attorney can look at. And I'm sure we'll come up with some other materials to send along. But yeah, let's just keep talking about this stuff, and I won't go into my spiel about the mom and pop landlords.
Yeah, we can talk about that more. We have got like 1 minute left.
Yeah.
But we could have that discussion because, you know, it's fair to have those discussions.
That's going to come up. I mean, every city that we do this in, there's a big debate about that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you'll have landlords coming to testify, and the landlord associations will have strong opinions about this as well. So it's good to kind of flesh out some of the issues ahead of time. So we'll start just kind of like providing some of our perspective on that.
We've talked to a lot of people, and some of them own homes, and actually some of there are high road like rent, they want to rent out their property, but they want to do it in a way that meets like ethical like requirements. They want to be a good actor on this stuff. And it's just really important to keep in mind that the mom and pops who want to do right, it actually does cost money to do repairs in your house, which means you might end up having to be competing with someone who doesn't. So I think it's also just important to keep in mind that a lot of these things are helpful for high road mom and pop landlords, right? They want to do the right thing, and doing the right thing can sometimes cost you money. And so I think it's just important to keep that in mind also. And yeah, like I said, we talked to a couple, at least I've talked to a couple of homeowners who support it and want other landlords, they want to do the right thing and also support it. So I think it's just good to keep that in mind that standards can be good for those people who want to do the right thing.
Okay, great. And you're always sending anything that you think of on, send it to Laurel, because then she can, you can send it to us, but the easiest thing is to get Laurel's email, then she'll distribute it to us.
Okay.
And yep. That would be best. That's
yeah, we communicate, so she has it.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to give everybody 14 minutes before our next meeting, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you both for coming.
This meeting is adjourned.